October is here, and that means it's time for light sweaters and 80-degree weather and a new episode of AZMcast. This month, we get another visit from the world's worst ER doc while Jared and I discuss CrossFit and the rhabdomyolysis and compartment syndrome that usually ensues thereafter. Brian Drummond wants to know why you're giving cephalexin to that Tufts fracture and has some papers to back him up. Finally, we cap off with some words of wisdom from Peter Rosen on dealing with conflicts in patient care. All this and more on this month's AZMcast. Actually, not more. Just that. But it's still good. You should totally listen.
This is Dr. Mosier. Somebody paged?
Hey, Dr. Mosier. It's Aaron Leach again in the ED. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing? What do you have for me today?
I got a patient I need to admit to you. How's your cough, by the way?
It's good. Thank you.
You sound a lot better.
Thank you. It was good.
So I got a guy, he's a 42-year-old guy with a tib-fib fracture that I need to admit to you.
I'm the ICU attending, man. You got to call medicine.
I did. I called medicine. They didn't want to take him because he's got renal failure.
Why? Is he dialysis dependent or something? Chronic renal failure?
No, I didn't see a fistula or a vas cath or anything like that. He's a pretty healthy guy. He's actually a triathlete. But he's got renal failure. He's got a high creatinine today, so medicine didn't want to take him. Ortho didn't want to take him either.
How high?
5.8, so he's probably pretty dehydrated or something. So I've given him a liter of fluids.
That's weird, man. Any other abnormalities?
Let me see. His white count's fine. He's not bleeding. His liver enzymes are up, like 300-400 a piece, but I don't know, maybe he's a drinker or something. No, everything else is fine. His potassium's okay.
So is he in rhabdo?
I don't think so. He wasn't working out today. He wasn't doing anything different. He just fell off a roof.
If he wasn't working out today, why would his creatinine be high from dehydration?
It's hot out here, man.
How's his leg?
It's all kinds of jacked up, man. This thing is like split in half. Ortho's wanting to take him into the OR once you fix his kidneys. We're trying to get his pain under control right now. That's the big issue. So you may even have to intubate him, you know, beforehand.
He's having that severe pain?
Oh, real bad pain. Real bad. So, yeah, we've given him a ton of narcs. I was going to get a nerve block ready for him, too. I saw that on Twitter that you can do a nerve block. Did you know you can say all kinds of stuff on Twitter, man? I mean, it's like, why even go to medical school anymore? Everything's on Twitter.
Is that how you do your CME?
Yeah. Why?
Well, I can tell you, really, your practice is getting better.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Oh, that's so nice to hear.
Does he have compartment syndrome?
No, because he's just got pain, but he's right now he says he can't feel anything, actually, so I think we gave him enough narcs. He can't feel his leg. It can't. Let me call you back.
Happy October.
Happy October, Jared.
How you doing?
I feel a whole lot better.
You know what's amazing is I can have this whole conversation without coughing this month.
That is amazing. That's fantastic. So this month we're talking about orthopedic injuries. And rather than try to walk people through orthopedic fracture reduction via voice, although I have talked a friend of mine through a shoulder reduction. He reduced his own shoulder over the phone. That was pretty fun.
Nice.
So shoulder reduction. reductions and fracture reductions and, you know, what to look for. I thought we'd talk about something that we need to recognize quickly so that we can get the right people on board. So we're going to be talking this month about compartment syndrome. Compartment syndrome is something that we should be able to pretty easily pick up on a physical exam, but I'm surprised at how often I have not seen it. And one of the keys, if you don't remember anything else, is serial exams. Go back and examine your patient multiple times. Sometimes it's a pain to go back into the room when the nurse says that patient that you just gave two of Dilaudid, they're still complaining of pain. All right, cinch up your belt, go back in, re-examine them, talk to them, and see, you know, if something is starting to develop. Because I've had a few people develop it while in the ED, which is quite embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting is, when I think I probably went my entire residency with only seeing like one or two cases of compartment syndrome, and we all associate it with, you know, distal tibia fractures or long bone fractures, things like that, crush injuries and whatnot. But the most common reason I've seen compartment syndrome in the last probably 4 years or so is CrossFit. And well, you know, if you think about what's interesting about it is the muscle groups that are devoted towards one action are surrounded by a sheath so that you increase the efficiency of those muscle contractions, right, and the action on the joint that causes. And when you exercise, you have peripheral vasodilation for improvement in regional blood flow to your muscles. So that's going to lead to, you know, an increased compartment pressure at baseline in whatever muscles you're using. So if you go to CrossFit, and this is the most common story I've heard at CrossFit, and you're doing like 100 pull-ups or push-ups or whatever, people get upper extremity compartment syndrome.
You know, I started doing CrossFit last week.
Did you?
No, I didn't.
You can't do 100 push-ups.
No, I can't do 100 of anything. And that's exactly why I don't do CrossFit, is because of this. So it's not because I only weigh 130 pounds. So compartment syndrome as a whole, you have to have increased compartmental contents, decreased compartmental volume, or just increased kind of capillary edema. You have to have swelling. And it's swelling enough to cut off your neurovascular supply. So some of the ones you talked about, the common ones, are going to be tib-fib fracture, supracondylar fracture in kids, areas where you're going to have a lot of injury and it'll start to swell. CrossFit is a new one, and I have seen that as well. I've seen people put themselves into rhabdo, and then I've seen it be tense enough, not enough to require a fasciotomy, but tense enough to where we've admitted them. They've had pain out of proportion. And we say, oh my goodness, your CK is 25,000. That's not good. Do you feel healthy now? So the other thing that we'll see on the opposite end of the spectrum, and you've had two of these in the last week you were telling me, is what's the opposite of CrossFit? Drinking and falling down on an extremity to the point of where you've cut off all of your supply. And you have basically ischemia and a reperfusion injury that causes compartment syndrome.
Yeah, I had one person that did a bunch of heroin and laid on his leg appropriately enough to cut off the blood supply, and he had complete neuropraxia of the sciatic nerve, and his CK was like 150,000. And another person got drunk and laid on their arm, and it's not uncommon to see that in college kids, right? They get drunk, they pass out, they pass out with their arm up and their head on their shoulder, and they cut off that blood supply. And they end up with rhabdo.
So another push to make sure that you do serial exams on your intoxicated patients, because intoxicated patients are here to embarrass you as a physician. They hide things very well. And if you don't go back and keep checking in on them, you might miss something big like that. One of the worst compartment syndromes I've ever had was a guy who just came in complaining of excruciating leg pain. And when you go to touch his calf, it felt like marble, and it was from his foot to his calf to his thigh to his glutes, and he got four compartment fasciotomies of his thigh. He got fasciotomy of his of his calf and his thigh and his glutes, and his CK peaked somewhere around 250,000, and his urine came out like Coke. it was really, really bad. And he ended up needing dialysis for a while. He was on CRT. So these can be pretty rough. You have to make sure that you're looking for something like compartment syndrome. So some of the other scenarios you can think of is if you've got somebody, you can bleed into a compartment and cause it. So if you've got a hemophiliac, you can consider that. If you've got somebody with a vascular injury, maybe somebody that just got a cardiac cath, they can bleed into a compartment potentially. You can have snake bites, one of our favorites here in Tucson. If you get somebody bit on a limb and they don't get treated for a while, all that coagulopathy and that edema from the toxins can cause more swelling in a compartment syndrome as well. And then some of the burns, electrical burns that they always say burn deeper than it looks. You want to be cautious for that as well.
Yeah, anything that is an enclosed space, you can get compartment syndrome. So in the ICU, we worry about abdominal compartment syndrome and things like that too. So
in examining these patients, we kind of want, everybody wants to use the Stryker right away. But before, we actually need to consider, you know, does this patient have compartment syndrome? So that's when you're looking for your five P's. So you're looking for pain out of proportion to exam. You're looking for pallor, so bad perfusion. You're looking for paresthesias, bad nerve supply. Pulselessness, and my favorite, poikilothermia, which if that didn't start with a P, I don't know what they'd use for another P to describe cold, but basically cold. You're looking for these, and these are really good indicators that you may have compartment syndrome, but what they're actually better at is telling you you do not have compartment syndrome. So, you know, I was taught if you have pain out of proportion of exam, that's going to be the first thing you'll find, and then the other four are going to be later. If you don't have any of those, then you got a pretty good chance that you don't have compartment syndrome. But once you start to develop those, then it's kind of hazy. I mean, you know, are they developing paresthesias because they're on their splint, or maybe they have a nerve injury as well? I think pulselessness is tough to argue, especially when you go in with a Doppler and look. But there are lots of these other ones that don't quite pan out to you have one of the five P's, you have compartment syndrome. Their positive predictive value is not that great, but their negative predictive value is fantastic.
Yeah, if you miss an early compartment syndrome in somebody who's got one of those things, whatever, it's because you weren't suspicious of it. If you miss it when they have all six of those, it's because you didn't even look.
Mm-hmm. There's a sixth one?
Five.
When you the sixth one being poor medical care. Yeah. So once you've decided you're worried that your patient has this, you need to. There are some other things that you can use to pick it up. So CK was one of the things. We keep talking about rhabdo. When we talk about the CK as one of the fallouts, it builds up, it causes renal failure, and you need to treat that. You need to have source control, similar to a septic patient. So the patient in the World's Worst ED phone call, that patient needed to go to the OR first to have his compartments open before then the ICU could put them on dialysis and CRT if they needed to. But you need to have a suspicion for this. So CK can also be somewhat diagnostic for you. And CK is generally greater than about 4,000, should be concerning for compartment syndrome in the setting of a clinical picture that looks like compartment syndrome. One thing to keep in mind is that the skeletal muscle releases CK. That's pretty specific to your skeletal muscle. But it also releases AST and ALT. And those are things that lots of different organs release. So your liver releases that, your skeletal muscle releases that, even your heart to some small degree releases that. But if you start seeing elevated transaminases in a setting that doesn't make any sense, everybody thinks it's the liver. Why? It's the LFTs. It's a liver function test. But it has nothing to do with your liver.
Okay, so what do you do? Okay, a patient comes in, their CK is 150,000 or even 5,000. That's easy, right? They're going to get admitted, hydration, renal clearance, that kind of stuff. Well, what if it's 400?
For a CK?
Yeah, what do you do?
So if it's 400 and they have, are we talking about compartment syndrome?
No, let's say they come in. Your exam's not consistent with compartment syndrome, but they've got pain and their CK is 400. Border crosser patient's a good example.
If I'm concerned that they've got a good story for rhabdo, we've got patients that come across the border in the middle of the summer and they come in, they look dehydrated. I'm going to be treating them for a while. I think that's a good time to trend it and see which way am I going. Is your CK going from 400 to 4,000 or is it going from 400 to 500 and they can reliably go home and rehydrate themselves? I think that's reasonable. Marathon runners bump their CK routinely and we don't admit, you know, a large majority of them for IV hydration. So I tend to trend it. There are some specific numbers, which I'll have to look up, to when you actually need to admit. But I usually will trend these exams, and I'll also look at the patient's clinical appearance.
Yeah, so in the days that we face right now, where the emergency is the fact that you've got 50 patients in the lobby, not the fact that you have a border crosser who's dehydrated, has acute kidney injury, and a CK of 500. How long do you watch them for and rehydrate them for before you recheck it? Or do you just admit them? Or do you say, I'm going to give you 2 liters and send you home? I think the way that you and I would do it, the way we want to do it, is not consistent with the way somebody in private practice may do or the way the healthcare delivery systems may want that done.
Well, that's a good question. That's why we have our peer reviewers from outside. So maybe that's a question they can field. If you've got somebody that's got maybe mild rhabdo, what are you going to do with them? Do you just admit them straight off? Do you try to rehydrate them and send them home? I think one of the other interesting questions is, let's say they don't want to stay. Then what do you do? Do you say, well, maybe we should stay here and trend you and see how you do? Or do they say, just go ahead and find, go home, come back if you feel worse? So there's a couple different ways to question that. I mean, that's what I would do. I'd be curious what other people would do.
What's your personal threshold as to keeping somebody or keeping them for a few more hours, rehydrating and rechecking? What's your personal threshold?
My personal threshold, I think it's somewhere around 2,000, 5,000, somewhere around there.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Mine's 400.
400?
To recheck it, to rehydrate them and recheck it.
So as we're looking at this, remember that your AST and ALT will also bump in skeletal muscle. And that's a good thing to consider because you'll have, we check CMPs on lots of people, and you'll have bumps in the AST and ALT. And it's one more thing to put in the back of your mind. Could this patient maybe have rhabdo or compartment syndrome? Remember, drugs can give you rhabdo as well. So some medications can put you into rhabdo. And we can consider that when we're working up a patient to see why are they having pain, why are they, you know, having why are they having their other symptoms that they came in with. So a CK is an easy test, and I've caught 2 patients, which isn't a whole lot, but it was pretty significant when you start to see the AST and ALT bump. Another thing to consider is that the compartment syndrome doesn't have to happen in those places that are common, like the tib fib or the femur or the supracondylar region. You can have compartment syndrome in your foot. You can have compartment syndrome in your hand. You can have compartment syndrome in your butt. If you've got a compartment, if you've got a fascial plane that's closed, you can get compartment syndrome there.
If you decide to tackle the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy, you'll probably get gluteal compartment syndrome.
Yeah, if you try to tackle, especially if you go from The Hobbit all the way through to Return of the King, you're almost certain to get compartment syndrome and a DVT, mm-hmm. probably. So be aware that you've got other places that you can look also. So you want to look for other areas like the hand, other areas like the foot. And hopefully in those patients, it'll be a little bit easier to pick out because they'll be complaining of it in that area. So if it looks like pain out of proportion to exam, poikilothermia, paresthesias, pallor, pulselessness, but it's not in the spot that I've seen it before, you can still consider maybe they actually do have something there and that you should be concerned about it enough to have them admitted to have an orthopedist see them. Maybe even just to check a CK and to see if it's elevated, because you should start to get muscle death with compartment syndrome, which is what's causing the pain.
So walk us through what compartment syndrome actually means.
So compartment syndrome, you've got swelling in the compartment to the point of where you've got compromise of your vasculature, compromise of your nerves, and compromise of the muscle tissue around it, and you're starting to get cell death of those myocytes. And usually when we have a suspicion, we'll start to measure a pressure. So to measure a pressure, the magic number for your compartment syndrome diagnosis is 30 millimeters of mercury. So we'll check this a variety of methods. The Stryker method is the most common one that I've seen, because you know they have their machine out there and you plunk that down into the compartment and see what your pressure is. People have tried to do non-invasive methods. There's a method for testing hardness that actually hasn't borne out to be as good as compartment pressures. But even the compartment pressures themselves, if you as an emergency doc are going to measure them, then you've got a good chance of finding it. But a lot of times the orthopedist will rather watch them. Sometimes they'll measure the compartment and then decide from there. But there's a wide variation between orthopedic surgeons of who's going to measure the compartments and take them to the OR for a fasciotomy and who's not if it's a soft call. If you don't have that cool little Stryker method, you can actually measure it with an arterial line. I will now be reading from Roberts and Hedges, Chapter 54, Figure 5. So the arterial line system that you can set up, you get an 18-gauge needle or a spinal needle if you need to go deep enough. You get some of the high-pressure tubing and a transducer that you would use for an ART line, and you get some sterile saline just to kind of get it all prepped. You get your pressure monitor that you can hook up the same as you would hook up to an ART, same as you would hook up your ART line to the monitor. And then you get one 20 ml syringe. So what you do is you position the patient, you get them set, you connect your cable, and then you put a stopcock on there and have the high-pressure tubing set up to one side. You have your syringe set up to another, and you've got your needle to the last one. So you get your syringe with about 15 mLs of water, and you put it on one of the stopcocks of the syringe, and you allow that to kind of fill up the transducer and get everything primed. Then you open up the stopcock to air, put the transducer at the height of the compartment. That's always important with your ART lines to make sure that it's at the level of the patient. It's not too high or too low. And then lastly, you zero it out up top. Make sure that it's off to the stopcock is off to the patient, and then put it into the compartment. If you need to know exactly which compartments you're heading into, then I would definitely look it up again in a book like Robertson Hedges. But you insert it into the compartment, then you open the stopcock, and you have you got to make sure that you're holding it nice and still. Otherwise, you're going to have some artifact. But then once you open it up, then you will actually be able to measure the compartment that's in there. You let it equilibrate a little bit and see what it's going to be. And then you can do this a couple times, take the average between them, make sure that you've got similar readings every time you do it. And again, the magic number is going to be 30, so look for that number to help you decide what you're going to do. But a lot of times, depending on where you work, you know, your orthopedist will come in and do it, or they'll say, well, don't worry about that, we'll do it later. Make sure you anesthetize the patients as best you can, too, because you're sticking a needle into the area that hurts the most.
Yeah, I just want to put out a call to the ultrasound people that there has to be a way to measure this ultrasonographically. All right, there's got to be a way. Figure it out. Just like, I don't want to hear, oh, speckling and dirty shadowing and all that stuff. No. Figure out a way to measure the pressure in the blood vessels in that compartment.
It's a good idea to be due by the next year when we talk about ortho.
Exactly.
And then we'll have it all set.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable to set those guidelines. I don't even do research that way, so I'm sure it's not that hard to do. We could probably get that through an IRB and like...
Tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow, I'm sure. The final disposition for these patients is to go to the OR if they have compartment syndrome. They need...
Oh, whoa. Is that universally true?
So what else are you going to do to manage the compartment syndrome?
Watch it.
watch it get worse?
Well, I mean, how do you know it's getting worse? I'm sure there is a lot of compartment syndrome out there. I mean, we just said all these CrossFitters that come in that have rhabdo. That rhabdo is from something. It's probably from mild compartment syndrome in their upper extremities. They don't go rushing off for fasciotomy, bilateral upper extremity fasciotomy.
Maybe they should.
I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I don't think that we can say compartment syndrome must go to the OR.
That's very true.
I think that you must consult the person that would take them to the OR.
That's very true. So the final disposition for these patients, I'm trying to decide if I leave this in and expose my idiocy, or if I just start over from here.
Whatever you want to do.
So the final disposition for these patients is going to be to have them admitted, have them seen by an orthopedic surgeon, correct any electrolyte issues, and get them hydrated so that it doesn't box their kidneys from all this dead muscle that they're spilling. Maybe people that do CrossFit should get fasciotomies of their pecs, and that's probably one of the steps that you know you're doing enough CrossFit. If you don't see the fasciotomy scars on the pecs and on the arms, you clearly haven't been doing CrossFit.
It's not your badge of honor.
Yeah, exactly. And you can have the brand of whatever CrossFit place you go to put over top of each one.
Exactly.
I think that'd be good. People will be faking it, though. Mm-hmm. Be going in, just slashing their pecs just so it looks like it. So.
I think if you have evidence of death, limb ischemic death, that patient for sure needs a fasciotomy. If you just have mild to moderate compartment syndrome, I would be comfortable if the orthopedic surgeon said, let's watch it for a bit.
I guess there's probably some overlap between just rhabdo and compartment syndrome that needs to go to the OR. You know, you might just have pain from rhabdo. You know, I have seen lots of patients from CrossFit that come in and put themselves into rhabdo, but they don't have the clinical signs of compartment syndrome where they've got a tense, swollen area of muscle with pain out of proportion. Some of the other stuff, they just got rhabdo.
I bet you if you measured their compartment pressures, they'd be elevated. I think it's probably not an on-off thing, right? It's not you don't have compartment syndrome or you do have compartment syndrome. Oh, yeah. I think it's a spectrum.
I'm sure it's a gradient. I'm sure you're absolutely right. So this is a good time to call an orthopedic surgeon who, looking through some of their literature, it's still widely variable of who they're going to take to the OR as well. But generally, if they get that compartment, if they decide to check the compartment and it's greater than 30, that's at least in the orthopedic literature enough to say maybe OR time.
Yeah, the only reason I argue this point is what I don't want is to send the message that if you're in a community ED or whatever, that you need to make this your charge and take it up and demand that the surgeon take this patient to the operating room, right? I mean, I think your responsibility is to have the discussion.
No, you're right. And we do that when we do mock oral boards and such, of we'll give you a patient with Fournier's gangrene who's septic, and we'll say, well, the subspecialist says they'll be able to come in tomorrow and see him after you admit him, and they want to make sure you know the hard and fast emergencies that need to go in. I do think that it's an emergent consult to an orthopedic surgeon, but you're right. I think that there are some times where if you have a patient who's got a leg carved out of marble and the surgeon is saying, I don't know, we'll wait. You may need to have a nice long discussion. But yeah, not everybody that has rhabdo needs to go to the OR. I think that is at the discretion of the surgeon that's going to take them, as long as you have a good discussion with them.
I mean, let's face it, my legs are carved out of marble, and I'm not being rushed off to the OR for fasciotomies.
Hey, it's Brian again with the Journal Club for October 2015. So my thought is I'm going to switch to a little more of a case-based scenario with an addressing of a clinical question. So let's see how that works. Hopefully less numbers for you guys, more answers. So we'll take a case of, say, a 38-year-old male, we'll call him Brian, who decides to switch out his kegerator kegs and is lifting a keg and the keg falls and smashes his finger. He was trying to put on this nice seasonal porter on tap, but it just didn't happen. Now he's got blood everywhere. He's got an open fracture right on that distal phalanx. So he goes to the local ER, and yeah, they do an x-ray, and they see a fracture, and he's got a lack. It's probably 1.5 centimeters across his palmar surface. And so it gets cleaned and repaired. It looks really nice. And so they say, do you think you need antibiotics, Brian, to go home with? So that's the question we're going to look at. Does someone with an open distal phalanx fracture benefit from antibiotic therapy preventing an infection down the road? So if you do a mini deep dive on this, there's really only three trials since 1987 to now that look at this question at all. The first trial was in 1987 from Sloan, and it was actually stopped early after just 10 patients in the non-antibiotic group, and it showed that antibiotics helped. And then in 1990, Spurrock did a study as well. And he only had like 98 patients in his study, but they looked at all finger bone fractures, and they noticed no difference with prophylactic antibiotics preventing infections down the road. So the study we're going to look at is the Stevenson study from 2003 in the Journal of Hand Surgery. And this study was done in England, and this is a randomized placebo-controlled trial looking at prophylactic flucloxacillin in the treatment of open fractures of the distal phalanx in an accident and emergency department. And so Aaron will have the link for you on this one. So if you look at this one plus the other two studies, there's only less than 400 patients studied on this entire question in the literature. So we're going to look at the biggest study and see if that makes a difference in the most recent study. So in the Stevenson study, it was a randomized controlled trial in England, and this was in their accident and emergency departments, 1998 to 2000. And they had 193 patients, which had an x-ray proven fracture of the distal phalanx, and there was an open wound in all these patients. All these patients were in the ER. They were aged 16 to 88, so pretty much all comers. And all these patients underwent the normal cleaning, nail bed repair, debridement. I'm not going to get into nail bed repair. That's a whole other day. But they did a thorough cleaning, debridement, and anesthetize them, proper wound care at the bedside, try to repair the wound as best they could. And then they put them on either flucloxacillin or placebo. Flucloxacillin for 5 days, two pills, four times a day for 5 days, or placebo, the same thing. And then they followed the patients up at 4 to 5 days, and they had 100% compliance rate at 4 to 5 days. That's really good. Then they followed them up again at 14 days, and they followed them up again at 8 weeks. 8 weeks of compliance was only 67%, so not as good. But still, pretty admirable job to follow these patients up and see what happened. Very nice methods if you want to read the paper. And their results, and in the group with the flucloxacillin, there was 3 patients that had infections. And in the group with placebo, there were 4 patients with infections. So 3% and 4% difference with 3 and 4% patients. This was not statistically significant. None of these patients with infections had osteo or sepsis. And almost all these infections, 6 of the 7 infections, were staph. So their conclusions were, if I got an open fracture, antibiotics aren't preventing any infections. And so this is a really, actually a nicely done, if you want to look at a good randomized placebo-controlled trial, this is really nicely done. They showed where their patients went. They had very nice flow diagrams. They showed that they were the patient groups, the randomized, both the placebo and the patients on antibiotics were very evenly matched on multiple factors, nail bed repair, amputations, age. And this is the best data we have. So with this evidence, my takeaway is I'm not going to give antibiotics to Brian. He needs to go home, enjoy that nice seasonal porter he put on. And I'm not going to give him antibiotics that could cause him diarrhea or give him a rash. Now, this is a different question than an open fracture in general. But if you have a distal open phalanx fracture, those patients do not benefit from prophylactic antibiotics. Good wound debridement, good pain control, good closure of the wound, follow them up, same infection rate. So don't give them the antibiotics. Don't harm these patients. Don't give them an extra copay to pay. And that's it for the Journal Club. So that was our ortho article for this month. And we'll talk to you next month. If you have a topic you want me to do a mini deep dive or clinical question, send that information to Aaron, and he'll get it to me. And we'll go from there. All right, guys. Talk to you next month. Bye.
You ever disagreed with what someone wanted to do with one of your patients? Me neither. I don't know. Let's hypothetically say. Let's say that there was a nurse that didn't want to give the medication that you ordered. Let's say that there's a doctor that ordered you to give a medication that was just flat out stupid to do, and you know better. Let's say that there's a consultant that you called, perhaps for compartment syndrome, just as an example, who said, I think you're being ridiculous. There's no way this is compartment syndrome. Let's say that this happens a little more frequently than we might like to admit, and we have disagreements on care in the emergency department, even during emergencies. How do you deal with these conflicts? How do you deal with the fact that you think the care should be handled one way, and the consultant or another member of the healthcare team disagrees? I don't know. So I decided to ask Peter Rosen his opinion of dealing with consultants where there's a conflict, dealing with nurses or other members of the healthcare team when there's a conflict. What should you do about this? And how do you handle this situation so that the patient gets the care that they need?
Well, it's very difficult when you're not equals. If you're the resident and you're working for an attending who has the ultimate responsibility, then you basically don't have the right to change the management, even if you're sure you're right and he's wrong. And that can be a very painful problem. I'll never forget a case I had when I was a surgical resident. We were assigned usually only to patients that belonged to surgeons. But on nights we were on call, we covered the whole hospital. And I got asked to start an IV on a kid one night. And I was puzzled by it because this was an adult hospital and we almost never admitted children. So I went up and started his IV, and I asked the nurse why he was there, and she said he'd been admitted for gastroenteritis and was getting worse. I went back and talked to the kid because I was curious what a kid was doing in an adult hospital. And when I went over him, I discovered that he had appendicitis. And so I called his attending, who was a GP, and I said, there's been a big change in your patient since you last saw him. His pain is now localized in his right lower quadrant, and I think he's got appendicitis. Do you want me to get one of the surgeons to see him? He said, thank you, I'll take care of it. So I went back a couple hours later, and nothing had happened. And I was worried about this kid. He looked to me like he was about to rupture his appendix. So I was thinking about calling the OR and taking him to the OR. I'm not sure how I would have carried it off because I'm sure they wouldn't have let a resident, even no matter how vigorously I lied. And I ran into one of the surgical attendings. And I told him about the case, and he said, well, the first thing you do is call the guy back and tell him that the kid's worse, which I did. And I got a message from his son who answered the phone that he'd gone to the movies. And then I told the surgical attending that. And he said, the next thing you do is go away. This is no longer your case. You can't do anything about it. I will take care of it. And he called the chief of service and and they called the guy in and mandated a surgical consult. Kid did not get operated that night. He didn't get operated till the next afternoon. And he did have a ruptured appendix, but he did okay, being a kid. But I remember feeling like, what do? I know this is wrong. And yet, I really didn't have the right to take the kid to the OR. I think when you are an equal with the other physician, then it again depends on whose patient it is. I've remembered a couple of times working in a private emergency department when I was obligated to call a consultant whom I didn't respect and who I knew was just going to make a shambles of the case. And then what I would do is tell the patient, I'm supposed to call Dr. Green because he's on call tonight. But of course, if you want me to call Dr. Red, I'll be happy to do that. And then I would whisper, I'll never admit that I told you this, but I wouldn't send a sick dog to Dr. Green. So I always get the patient to tell me that it's okay to call Dr. Red. When there's no other option and you have to deal with the other consultant, then I call upon whatever works to make them behave. And part of that is saying, okay, you're telling me to do something stupid. I'm not going to do it. You come and see the patient. You put your name on the chart. You take care of the patient, and I'm out of the case. You do whatever you want. But I'm not doing it and then having you later deny that you ever heard from me or told me to do that. If you don't want to take care of this patient, then fine. Tell me that, and I'll get someone else. There are plenty of other people who will. Sometimes it's a matter of pleading with them. Look, I'm just a stupid emergency physician. Please help me. I don't know what to do for this. You're the expert. That's why I'm calling you. Please come and see this patient. That works some of the time. And then sometimes you just have to shame them. I was admitting a patient to an internist one night in Denver, and it was a internist, and they are about the laziest work-averting species you've ever encountered. And I was feeling pretty proud of myself because a patient appeared to have primary adrenal insufficiency, and you may see one of those per medical lifetime. So I was proud of that. I even thought of it, but I was pretty sure that was the right diagnosis. So I called this guy, and I'm telling him about the case, and he interrupts me and says, could you hurry up? I'm in the middle of dinner. And I said, whoa, I'm sorry. Could you put the doctor on the phone? I thought I was talking to the doctor. And it got very quiet, and then he said, okay, tell me about the patient. I think that part of it is to talk with people and accept the relationship as to who has the authority. If it's someone else's patient, there really isn't much you can do about it. You can express your opinion. Don't write it in the chart. That doesn't do anybody any good. But also, don't be afraid to confront the physician. You have to be polite, but you have to be firm and say, look, what if there is a chance that this would work better? How about trying it? And then if they say, it's my case, I'll do it my way, and it is their case, there's not much you can do about it except demand a quality review of the case afterwards.
What about when the disagreement is between a doctor and a nurse? And specifically with the residents, most of these nurses have been doing this longer than the doctors, and there's that transition period at which you do start to know more than your nurses. But when there's a nurse that disagrees with your order, then what do you do?
Well, once again, I ask her what the disagreement's about and give her my reasoning. I don't just order nurses. I try to explain what I want. And if they still don't want to do it, then I'll say, I'll tell you, you bring the medication, I'll give it. Or if it isn't something that's resolvable like that, then I'll say, how about we let the attending resolve this? And once again, go upstream. Don't leave it as a one-on-one, or my ego versus yours. I'm a doctor, you're a nurse. That doesn't work.
I can't even tell you how grateful I am to be able to ask questions like this to someone like Peter Rosen. This would be like asking Michael Jordan to help you with your jump shot, or asking Warren Buffett to help you with your investments. I mean, it's really great. So we want to extend this opportunity to all of our listeners out there. If you have a question you would like to ask Peter Rosen, please send me an email or visit us on Twitter and let us know what you'd be interested in hearing. And again, that'll flash below right now. I also want to make a comment that the bleep during the Peter Rosen was actually not profanity. It was actually the name of a type of internist, so that we don't offend internists as a whole. This was his experience. I just didn't want to indict anyone else. So hopefully you enjoy that, and hopefully we get some other very poignant questions to ask the godfather of emergency medicine.
Hello, everyone. This is Casey Solom coming at you from Phoenix, Arizona, with a little peer review for this month's podcast. For those who don't know me, I'm a graduate of the 2014 class of the university campus residency, and moved up to Phoenix a little under a year and a half ago and been practicing in four banner hospitals up here. One is academic somewhat, and the other three are very much community hospitals. I work at Banner University Medical Center, where we do have emergency medicine residents from Maricopa who rotate through, as well as off-service residents. We've got just about every consulting service available, trauma, ICU teams, everybody, basically very similar to what UMC was like down in Tucson. And then I range to hospitals all the way down to places where I'm honestly the only doctor in the building, and I got no consultants. And if it requires anything more than a simple hospitalist admission, and they're oftentimes at home writing orders, then I got to transfer the patient somewhere else because I don't have this resource is available. So hopefully that gives me a unique perspective to kind of help give some insight into the topics of this podcast. So we started off by talking about compartment syndrome. I think Leach and Mosier did a great job talking about this. They covered just about everything. Just briefly reviewing the causes, they said overuse injuries like CrossFit, altered mental status. Remember, I think it's Berkman always made a big point about remembering that the people who are going to screw you one day in your clinical practice are going to be psych patients and drunk patients, because they really can't tell you very clearly what's going on. They can't tell you what happened, and you have a tendency to kind of want to blow off the patient and be quick, move on to the next patient, because you get the sense that it's all just psych or it's all just alcohol. But remember, these people will screw you if you don't pay close attention. One more thing that we, or a couple issues that we didn't talk about that I wanted to bring up, is thermal burns. They can cause constriction of the tissue, and you get that eschar that squeezes down, and it can essentially cut off blood flow the same way that high pressures from within the compartments would. And then something that we didn't address but I think is really important is talking about casts and splints. So people come in saying that they feel like their fingers are going numb or tingly, or they're discolored while they've got a splint on. Remember, that's an emergency, and it's the same as having compartment syndrome. You got to get the dressing taken down and try to relieve some of that pressure. I make a point every time one of my nurses or techs or I place a splint on somebody in the ER to go back and document a neurovascular status after the splint's been put on. Make sure I document good cap refill, pulses if applicable, motor, sensory, and just make sure that there's all that. That's clear at the time of discharge that there was no increased pressure or evidence of compartment syndrome from the outward constriction. So we talked a little bit about compartment pressures and when to get concerned. Leach mentioned 30 being a number that should raise suspicion. I think that's a reasonable number. Something to keep in mind is that Tintinelli says normal pressures are about 10 millimeters of mercury, and you start getting concerned at about 20. And the way you're going to remember that is when you do that opening pressure on an LP, what's normal? You got it. It's less than 20. When you do Tonopen on an eye and you want to know whether to worry about glaucoma, you got it again. It's also 20 pressure there. And then finally for abdominal compartment syndrome, it's 20. So the reason is because at about 20 is when you start cutting off venous outflow. And at that point, then blood keeps pumping in through the arteries, but you can't get it back out, and you can get a runaway of the pressure at that point. So keep that in mind. The truth is, I'm glad that we didn't spend too much time focusing on exact numbers and when to start talking about fasciotomies, because you're not going to make that decision in a vacuum. At least I don't out in the, in my practice. Even outside of a university setting, out where I've got a little bit more of a rural experience, I still have consultants available I can call and bounce the idea off of them, and they can come in and talk about taking the patient to the operating room. This is definitely an emergency, but Tintinelli says you've got about 4 to 8 hours from the onset of the injury before you really start getting irreversible damage to the muscles. Not that you want to wait that long, but just remember, you don't have to be necessarily freaking out that making this decision right now, the second they hit the door, is all that important. You definitely got to make sure you don't miss it and know what to look for, including the 5 P's that they mentioned. Pain out of proportion, which is a big one. Anytime you see pain out of proportion anywhere in medicine, it's a problem. Pallor, paresthesias, pulselessness, and poikilothermia. I learned it as the 6 P's, including paralysis, but it doesn't seem like anybody talks about that anymore. Other things, though, that we didn't mention and I want to make sure gets out there is make sure you're documenting and checking for cap refill, and then squeeze the compartment itself and see, is it firm, is it rigid, or is it soft? That's not anything you can definitely hang your hat on, but it's certainly worth assessing and making sure that you're not ignoring it. And then finally, something that's pretty common in the literature is people talk about passive stretch of the muscles that are running through that compartment. So if you're worried about, say, compartment syndrome in the calf, flex and extend the ankle. And if it causes tremendous pain out of proportion, that's an indication that you might be experiencing some compartment syndrome. So something that they wanted me to talk about specifically was CPKs and how do I manage them. So one thing I wanted to get off the bat is you really have to ask me, or I have to clarify, am I worried about compartment syndrome or am I worried about rhabdo? Truly, if it's just a rhabdo situation, then I'll tolerate numbers a little bit higher than if I'm worried about compartment syndrome. And that's because if it's rhabdo from being dehydrated, from being outside in the heat, from overworking your muscles, or, you know, that CrossFit type situation, and generally the injury is already going to be done. And as long as there's no ongoing injury, if you've gotten them out of the heat and they're not exercising anymore in front of you, which they're not going to be in the ER, then if you can watch those CKs and hydrate them, you can generally find that things are going to improve and you can get them home doing relatively well. So I generally, I know that Mosher uses a number of about 400, Leach said a couple thousand. If I'm at about 800 or higher, I'm probably going to go ahead and give the patient a 2-liter bolus and I'm going to recheck it. If it's trending up, well, then I'm going to admit the patient. If it's trending down, I'll send them home. If it's about the same, I'm probably going to send them home. But, you know, the question was, in a community practice where I've got a whole lot of emphasis on turning my beds over and being quick, how do I approach these patients? If the numbers are really high, we're talking, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 or higher, I'll just admit them right off the bat. If there's any significant renal insufficiency, I'm going to admit them right off the bat as well. But if I'm sitting in that 1,000, 2,000 range, I'm probably going to go ahead and give a 2-liter bolus and recheck it. I can do that in about 2 hours, maybe 3 hours, depending on how quickly the lab's getting a turnaround. And that doesn't clog up my beds for too long. And at that point, then, I get a better idea of where I am. If I'm still trending up, well, then I know I'm not going to catch up. But what I don't do is what Jared and Leach were suggesting, which is that you potentially just talk about giving a patient a bolus of fluids and then sending them home. I don't believe that giving a bolus and then guessing that I know which direction things have gone is really safe for the patient, and I don't think it's right for me either. But there's a clear distinction. If I'm worried about compartment syndrome, that's a totally different story. In that case, I don't feel like the injury's done. In fact, the injury is still happening. Every minute that they have ischemia or infarction of that muscle, they're going to keep dumping CK. So if those patients, I'll probably look at a couple hundred, 400 maybe, and if you're above that level, I'm going to start moving on to consultation to my surgeons or even checking the compartment pressures myself. Another question that they had for me is, would you do compartment pressures on your own? And the answer is, I don't really have much of a choice. So I don't have orthopedic surgeons sitting around waiting for me to call them the way I did in residency. So in the one situation where I was concerned about a compartment syndrome out in my practice, I just did it myself. I pulled out the Striker and looked at the instructions, watched a YouTube video, and then started jamming and trying to figure out what the pressure was. So it's just a little bit different when you get out into clinical practice. Sometimes you got to just make that decision. Which leads me to what I wanted to get to before I end, which is just how do we use consultants? So there's a couple different reasons you're going to call a consultant. One is because they're the definitive care, like a surgeon has got to take the patient to the operating room. I'm not a surgeon. You're not a surgeon. We can't really fix the problem without the surgeon coming to take care of it for us. So that's a legitimate reason to consult somebody. Or if you need to arrange follow-up, again, I can't be the person to follow up something very easily. Or admissions. So if you got to get somebody moved upstairs, you're going to need a consultant to come take care of that for you. But what I want to make sure is clear is that we, as emergency physicians, we are the masters of the acute life-threatening emergencies, and we're masters of acute limb-threatening emergencies. So these aren't times like when you're concerned about compartment syndrome that you should be consulting somebody, asking them for advice. We should take ownership of the acute life-threatening emergencies and say, this is what we do, this is what we're trained to do, we can handle this ourselves. So I'm not going to call an orthopedic surgeon and ask them, should I check a pressure? No, I'm just going to check the pressure, and I'll call them with a number and say, now you determine, are you taking this patient to the operating room, or are we going to observe this patient? So take some ownership of the patient. And then lastly, when we're talking about consultants, we talked a little bit about what do you do when you've got a consultant you disagree with, or if they disagree with you. And the truth is, you got to remember, if they haven't seen the patient, if they haven't examined the patient themselves and put their opinion on paper, they're not really able to help you very much, because ultimately, you're the person who's seen them, you're at the bedside, you're responsible. So if a consultant comes and tells you over the telephone, you know, they recommend you do or don't do something, and ultimately there's a bad outcome, they'll be able to come back afterwards and say, hey, I didn't know the whole story. I wasn't there. Dr. Solem failed to mention to me those few details. And boy, if I would have known those, I would have given totally different advice. So keep in mind that you got to take ownership of your patient. If you're the one at the bedside, don't let them run you down a path of just blowing something off. If you feel like it's wrong, it probably is wrong, because in the emergency setting, in the acute life and limb-threatening emergencies, there's nobody better trained to handle those situations than you are and I am. So moving on to management, you're not going to be the one making the decision about going to the operating room in general, so I don't get too excited about what numbers and what the indications are for going to the operating room. My job is to get the consultant on board and let them make the best decision they can. But something we didn't mention is, what can you do as temporizing measures? Well, one is you can ice the extremity, and the other is you can elevate it and see if you can help to reduce some of the inflammation in the area, which can help to temporize issues and maybe potentially stave off a trip to the operating room, although it's probably not likely to do that very much. So I think that covers compartment syndrome. I think Dr. Rosen did a great job talking about dealing with other physicians. There's really nothing that I could possibly say that would top what he had to say, so we'll just leave that alone. Journal club with antibiotics in distal phalanx fractures seems pretty clear that the evidence shows there's not much benefit, so I'm probably not going to be quick to pull antibiotics on a distal phalanx fracture. And I have to identify that this is different than the average open fracture that we freak out about and send off to the operating room. The last thing I wanted to mention is that Aaron asked me to comment a little bit about my telemedicine experience and whether I use telemedicine out in my rural community practice. And the answer is somewhat. So with burn care, I do have access to telemedicine where they can both see and hear me and the patient, and they can actually take a look at the burns and help to determine whether emergent transfer is necessary or whether the patient can follow up in the outpatient setting. So it's really nice and helpful from that perspective. But beyond that, beyond burn care specifically, I'm just like everybody else, picking up a telephone and trying to describe what I'm seeing over the phone. So that wraps up my peer review for this month. I thought this was a great topic and something that's important both to our patients but also to us, because I think it carries a fair amount of medical legal risk with it. So thank you for allowing me to contribute, and thank you, Jared and Aaron, for continuing to make this podcast. It's a good resource and a good review for me, but it's also a good reminder of how much I miss you guys down there in Tucson. So everybody take care. Bye-bye.